this is Kevin Doherty, your host for Just Thinking. I am the Chief Strategy Officer for 806 Technologies, and today I have a very special guest. But before I introduce him to you, I want to give a little bit of context here. I've been in education for 40 plus years. This would be the start of my 41st year in education. Way back at the beginning of my teaching career, I had the good fortune to teach in my hometown of Bedford, Massachusetts. And there I was trained by Dr. Bob Swartz out of Boston University in something called critical and creative thinking, something that people weren't talking a lot about at the time. But as part of that course, we went to a seminar that was led by Dr. Art Costa. Well, he was brilliant, and I just loved everything that I learned. Well, fast forward 15 years from then, I went on to become a principal and taught many places. And then I was introduced to something called Thinking Maps. And I left being a public school educator to work for the Thinking Maps organization. And as a result, I had the great fortune to work with and to get to know the creator of Thinking Maps, whose doctoral dissertation panel chair was Dr. Art Costa. His name is Dr. David Hierley. So I would like to introduce you all, my good friend and a brilliant educator, researcher, and writer, Dr. David Hierley. David?
It's just great to be here. Thanks for the invitation and good to see you after a few years of not spending as much time as we used to together. It's really delightful because yesterday I spent the whole day with Art Costa, with Art. He's remains a mentor of mine. He's 91, 92 years old, and I'm happy to report he is still sharp as can be. It's sort of, I joke with him because I get together with him for lunch every month or two. And I say, Art, when are you going to retire? And he says, how do you retire from thinking? It's a lifelong endeavor. It's, if you give up on that, you give up on a lot. So it's always great to be with him. I always learn when I'm with him, for sure.
Well, David, you're an incredible thinker yourself. Not only did you create Thinking Maps, and I know that's constantly evolving, but I remember going to a conference, a big conference, maybe like an ASCD conference, and you were sitting there in the front. Art Costa was on the panel, and we had Bob Marzano and different folks there that were talking. And it's so funny, everything that they talked about that needed to happen to reform or transform education could have and should have been addressed using Thinking Maps. So, you have created something incredibly elegant and timeless and impactful. And I got to see it firsthand for almost 20 years. So I'm so glad you're here. David, you and I were talking a little bit before this call, and you talked to me about this sense of overwhelm that learners are feeling today with the onset of social media and the growth of social media. So talk to me a little bit more about your feelings and your observations around that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, all those folks, Bob Marzano, Pat Wolf with neuroscience background, all of the folks that were really, and Bob Schwartz even originally in the thinking skills movement of the 80s, was really about, lifelong learning. And we thought it was pertinent then. I think it's even, as you bring up, even more important now, because if you think about it, even in the 80s, it was basically text-based. It was, how do you verbalize your thinking and you read, or in mathematics, a lot of linear presentation of ideas, and the world of information has exploded, tech has exploded. I mean, it's just a dynamic place. In another 5 to 10 years, every child around the world is going to have a handheld device. If they don't have it right now in a hut in Ethiopia, where I've worked before, they're going to, if the family doesn't have one, they have one right next door. Well, with that just comes this amazing amount of information. It used to be held in books and libraries, and now it's right there. We know we can do searches. And with AI, we know that there's a dynamic space where things are being created. Well, along with that needs to come some perspective and some reframing about where are we now in education, I think, in the sense of what students need, what learners need from early on. And you see three-year-olds with iPads, right? This isn't unusual, right? So all the way up through adult learning, where we have this tremendous amount of information at our fingertips. So what's going on in the mind? What are the ways in which we can offer students and teachers and administrators and teacher leaders the wherewithal to support students in a continuous way over time, where they really are empowered to filter that information and really gain their own perspective, be able to communicate to others without conflict about what they're perceiving, being able to be aware of all the different access points and who's creating those. So I think it's sort of the Wild West of information now. And I don't see, by and large, there are a lot of folks working on it, but how do we really provide the tools? I think Thinking Maps is one way of helping students to filter and think through and be reflective on what they're seeing.
Yeah, you and I also touched base a little bit earlier about this idea of the focus on independent learning for learners.
Yeah.
So speak a little bit more about that.
Well, and I think that's also for us as educators. My wife is an artist. When she needs to, and also a woodworker, I mean, she just goes a lot of different mediums. When she wants to learn about something, she goes to YouTube. So it's the medium we live in, where we're all independent to a certain degree to be able to access information, and here's a how-to. So I think what's really key is we have these, we have existing standards, we have content we need to teach, and it's really ultimately going to be the processes for learning how to deal with content and all that's coming at kids now from a very early age. And there's a lot of approaches now, some of them AI-driven for independent learning, where students are taken through, and it's adaptive, but it's basically taking kids on pathways through their own learning journey. So how do we build into that, not just here's the content, try it again, here's another way of doing it, but actually having that sort of executive functioning, that control of like, oh, I see what's happening here. What do I need to do next? Rather than being sort of pulled along in the journey. Sort of the independent learning is really about true independence of an openness of mind to be able to, pursue your ideas on your own without being necessarily drawn through things. So it's an intriguing time.
As you're talking about that, earlier today, I spoke with someone that is a social worker. And we were talking about mental health of the educators, mental health of the learners. And one of the things we were talking about is how we're constantly pushing through. So we just go, 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 go. We never stop to really process, to decompress. And as you're talking about just the sense of overwhelm that learners can feel, or just people in general, with how much content is out there and at their fingertips on a constant basis, when do they stop to process all of this and to decompress? Do you have any thoughts on that as well, David?
Well, the good old research from Mary Budd Rowe 40 or 50 years on wait time told you enough. If, as teachers, we ask a question back then, I don't know what the present research is, but it used to be like teachers would ask a question and within 0.9 of a second, if they didn't get a response, they'd ask it again or ask it of another student. So that, I think maybe I hadn't thought about this in a long time until you asked me this question, but I think extended wait times, giving students time to reflect. One of the things is having them sketch out their ideas in different ways and then sharing them, one-on-one. Even Jay McTighe's Think, Pair, Share is still a really rich way of developing that sort of patience. And that gets internalized. Think, Pair, Share isn't just in the moment, but it's like later, I'm going to think about something I'm going to communicate with somebody else about it, and maybe we should share it with a larger group. So those are the kind of things that I think, in the hurry up classroom of today, when, I mean, teachers are just, I mean, I hear it, I feel it when I work in schools. They're going, oh, there's so much coming at us. I think the other thing is also having tools that really are adaptive, not having too many different models, too many different programs, but focusing on what is it that's really going to improve the students' abilities to think and think through ideas and also reflect and also emotionally reflect. I mean, I really believe in that way. How am I feeling about this? What is my frame of reference that's influencing how I'm feeling? So things like that, a reflective stance, and building in that time to do it.
I like what you said about the adaptive tools and having a more limited amount of tools, but tools that are adaptive so they can be applied in a lot of different situations. Makes me think of the work that we do with continuous improvement and encouraging people to streamline the goals that they have or the strategies that they're using so that they're not overwhelming the teachers and or the students. And because Doug Reeves, I think he talked about what. No more than at one point it was six goals that I saw him recently. He said, how about one? Do one and do it really well. So I love that, David. As you're talking, you've had an amazing career as an educator, as a researcher, as a creator, developer, writer. What's been some of the most rewarding aspects of your career through the years and the work that you've done?
I hear it often, almost every time I go back into a school that's implemented the MAPS, that because we work with whole schools, and that, and you were involved in that, you were deeply involved in that. I think what's really the most, the thing I value the most is the continuity of how do you create, and I know your work now is about implementation, and how do you really guide that and structure that and organizationally do that? And I think the tendency has been for really for a very long time to do, the new initiative, and everybody knows about that as a new thing that comes in. But I think what's been most rewarding is going back into a school that have been using the thinking maps for, let's say, 2, 3, 4, some of them 7 years. And what that tells me, and what I hear from teachers and students, is there's been continuous support going from sort of novice to expert. And that's not just with the students, but with teachers and teacher leaders and administrators. So when I, that is the most fulfilling thing to me, that it's not a one-shot deal. There was actually a book, and I'm trying to remember, it was something like the title was 58,000 classrooms can't be all wrong, something like that. And one of the point the authors went into classrooms across the country, and they went into thousands of them, and they actually mentioned thinking maps as one of the few approaches that had sticking power, that stayed in the school. And I believe that's because our design is whole school over time. And I know that's tough to pull off. That is, I mean, it is tough to pull off where you take an initiative, whether it's something like, let's say it's even when emotional intelligence, if you're bringing in something that's around diversity or something, staying with it, or a really new innovative mathematics program, or whatever it is, do you have a design for staying with it and following it? And I know that's to a certain degree what you do, I believe, is how do you actually track these things and keep them coordinated without, as Doug Reeves says, not seven things, but just one or two, and over time.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. In fact, that was one of my frustrations through the years was when people saw whether it was Thinking Maps or any other initiative as this year's new thing, and they gave it a very cursory sort of implementation, and then complained that it didn't have the impact that they anticipated it was going to have. And so embedding it thoughtfully into a continuous improvement plan was something that was just so essential. And there were districts, there were schools that did that. You know, you think of the work of Edward Chevalier way back in the day,
Oh,
right?
absolutely. Yeah, that
I
was in
mean,
Texas, wasn't it?
yes, outside of Dallas. But it was embedded in his plan. It was an integral part of everything that they did. And that's why it was, and they monitored it on an ongoing basis. They did the formative reviews to make sure what's working, what's not working, made adjustments if needed. I mean, it was just so much a part of the process in his implementation. And then, you know, the importance of building that capacity, and that has its drawbacks as well. You and I have talked through the years about the train the trainers model. I mean, there are pluses and minuses, sometimes more minuses because you're trying to spread it, you know, far and wide. And so in some instances, it's a mile wide and an inch deep. But I have seen instances where it's gone deeper than that, where the organization itself really truly took it on beyond what an organization was providing for training to train the trainers, if you will. They each year they would revisit periodically throughout the year. They would do study and deepen their understanding, and they just and therefore their implementation became more and more impactful and remained sustained for well over a decade. So that was awesome to see as well.
And it really it made me think maybe I'm being too focused on the thinking maps, but let me just say if there's something that Piaget identified, that cognitive psychologists have identified, and that is as human beings, as we're born with these fundamental processes in mind and brain, and they develop over time and they get orchestrated over time. But typically, what happens, well, not typically, almost everywhere, that's just happening under the surface. So I think when we started with that design of whole school and then moving into feeder patterns, the idea is that it's so important for cognitive development and thinking abilities to have that continuous development. You don't hodgepodge something like that. I mean, maybe there are other programs we can hodgepodge a little and get away with it. But it seems to me it's so foundational to us as human beings, how we think through our feelings and our emotions even. And if that's hodgepodged, which it has been, basically forever in formalized education, then we're losing that human intelligence that I mean, it's a crescendo now. This we need it, sort of going back to what we started with, we need this more than ever now. Students need that continuous facilitation of their thinking so they become independent. That wasn't necessarily the case in the 50s or when Dewey was writing his book How We Think in like 1919. Now it is. Even though all those works are still important, we're in a different place.
Well, so that's a great segue. So where are we now in education?
I jokingly call it paradigms lost. I think we're in limbo. I think we don't exactly know where we're going. And because of the rapid growth of technology and how that influences classrooms and how that influences structures of education, and it also influences how, when learners go home, their caregiver or parents or extended family, do they have access to that technology? So I think there are issues of equity around technology, and even more importantly, I think that it's how do we really, put in their hands adaptive technologies that help them filter information and ideas? And to me, that's going to be key. And by the way, that all leads to better learning, higher quality learning of content. If it's content we want, at a basic level, to get those standards, to nail those down, because we don't want people to be stepping into high school and out of high school, without literacy or fundamentals of mathematics. So we have to have that impact there, and we also have to think about that filtering of information and how the human mind and brain works and how to facilitate that. I mean, in very concrete ways. It can't be this abstract, philosophical, let's think about great ideas, which is part of it, like great books. And we have to think about the day-to-day life of teachers and students.
I love how when you're talking about the cognitive processes and thinking, you talk about it as being equally important for the emotional side of things as the academic side of things. So you were just saying, like, if content's the, the most important thing and so forth. And Dr. Ray McNulty was talking about that on a recent podcast and how sometimes content becomes king and that's all we focus on, right? And then I interviewed a superintendent in East Texas, Lamont Dean, who's just an incredible leader. And his focus as superintendent in the district in which he grew up. So he grew up there as a kid, went all the way through college, came back, now he's superintendent of schools. And his focus is kids before content.
Yeah.
Kids before content. Content is not unimportant. He's not minimizing the importance of the content, but he's saying, if we don't focus on our kids first, all of our kids, every kid, and then content follows that. And I think about that so often with, the maps, for instance, that focus on the frame of reference, that every learner brings a unique perspective, point of view, and experiential background to the learning. So whether you're using thinking maps or you're using however you want to gather the information, of course, we know the power of gathering it visually. Again, thinking maps, right? Any other way, gather visually, but putting that frame around it to gather that information, I've seen that be such a powerful tool at, having a much more equitable approach to how we address the learning of every learner.
Yeah, and I think it goes to, what you're saying is really about student voice. How do we support students in surfacing what's going on for them? I made an association from way back. Daniel Goleman, before he really became known for emotional intelligence, he wrote a book. What was it? It was called something like Vital Lies, Simple Truths, The Psychology of Self-Deception. And in that book, it struck me because I was working on, how to really integrate the frame of reference in. He said that it's about schemas, the classic schema theory. But he said emotions really are driven by these schemas. So he said schemas are the ghost in the machine. It's probably a metaphor he wouldn't use now. The mind is a machine. But the thing is every child has this array of ideas and feelings and experiences. And so how do we help them surface that, understand how it's influencing how they're seeing the world? And, they read a piece of fiction. They read about history. They're learning about civics, a presidential election. What's influencing how they're going to be perceiving that? And it's their background. It's what are your influences? So when you bring up the frame, to me, that it's the cognition. We know these processes of sequencing and causality and comparisons, all of those. And we can even see it in the research on critical thinking for, thousands of years. But it's that frame of reference. It's how do we see how we're perceiving something and then how we're open to each other's frames of reference. So I can listen to you. I can ask you about, hey, where did you get those ideas? Not just like, not sarcastically, like, what are you thinking about? It's like, how are you thinking about it? And actually, Art, I just want to say that a turning point in my career was when Art said, it isn't the question we often ask is, what are you thinking? He offered that we ask, how are you thinking about it? And it's just to me that seems like, semantics, but it's not really. It's like, what are you bringing that supports and ignites your ideas? So,
But David, to kind of bring you back, I remember going through a leadership training when we talked about the asking the question in that way to make the shift from positional thinking to possibility thinking.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I love that. Well, speaking of possibilities, possibilities are limitless for what's going on out there in the world, especially with the onset of artificial intelligence. So, what are your thoughts around that? I know we talked about it a little bit earlier, but and how that relates to this whole idea of critical thinking or, just human intelligence.
I've been really animated by the AI world growing, and I've been, I'm no expert in it, and but so sort of secondary knowledge, if you will, but reading quite a bit about it. And my favorite author is this guy named Ray Kurzweil, who wrote a book, How to Create a Mind. I think it came out in 2011, and he was basically saying, the problem with a lot of AI and the development of AI is that it's sort of mechanistic. It's can you build the algorithms that somehow reflect what's going on in the brain? He said we need to take a different tact. And he said most folks in AI don't have a theory of mind. They have a good idea what's going on in the brain. And he said what we have to focus on is what's going on in the mind. And he identified five fundamental processes, and you know them well because they ground the thinking maps. Knowing the context, that's what we do as human beings. We scan as if we were on the savannah from thousands of years ago, right? We pick up information, our body picks up the sensory information. So describing, the ability to describe those and compare, they run a sequentially across neural networks, so sequencing, and then it's actually goes through a filter of categorization in the brain, and it's distributed to different regions of the brain. So I'm reading this, I'm going, just a minute, Ray Kurzweil, who's like the guru of AI, has basically identified the processes that Piaget and many other cognitive scientists have identified for years, and also it grounds the thinking maps. That makes sense, right? And so that really brought me to the place of, okay, what we really need to do is focus on human intelligence and some of these fundamental foundational processes and make them explicit for kids. They're already there in the curriculum. So if I recently was talking to somebody, I said, hey, put those words up there on the in the front of your room, every teacher, context, describing, categorizing, comparing, sequencing, cause and effect reasoning. These are the fundamental things that our brain is doing. We know the brain is always predictive, right? Which is what Kurzweil is talking about. So why not make it explicit for kids? This is what I call now, I'm writing a book called The Cognitive Code, which is saying, gosh, what are these fundamental processes? Can we make it explicit for kids? So my answer to the AI dilemma is, go for it. I think it's really powerful work. It's going to help in a lot of ways. It already does. And we radically need to shift, radical meaning a root strategy of saying, how do we facilitate human processing and human thinking and creativity? And being in touch with our emotions in the same way that as deeply influencing and a gatekeeper to a lot of things. So I think there's just it's an exciting time, but I think we're in this transition where we're sort of drifting. We don't know which way to go or how to do it. And so we're at that limbo state, what I mentioned before. I think we're there. I think we're going to push through to the other side and say, yep, content's important and it's about that metacognition. How are you thinking about that content? And what are the structures and patterns?
And we're not going to get there if we don't start having the conversations around it. So that's a great place to start. Well, speaking of conversations, I am coming to the close of this particular episode, David, but we're going to have to pick this up at another time because there's so much more I want to talk to you about. But for purposes of this episode today, is there anything else about which you're just thinking that I did not give you the opportunity to address during this conversation?
I'm just thinking because this is what I spent the day yesterday with Art Costa, my mentor, and Bob Garmston, developers of cognitive coaching and then habits of mind. And we're focused right now on the idea of efficacy. What does it mean in schools when learners of all ages are efficacious? What does that really look like in here 2025, here in 25 years from now, when a young child is really coming into adulthood in a big way? What is it to be efficacious in this world? So that's sort of a key term we're looking at in a concept, and we have a group, sort of a think tank, coming together around that. So I'm just thinking about that a whole lot.
Sounds like our next episode we'll have to be talking a little bit more about efficacy. So David, I look forward to talking to you again soon, but I want to thank you for today and for the conversation that we had. And there's so much that I learned from this conversation, and I've known you for many years. So again, thank you so much for being part of this today.
Very much appreciated. Conversations, it's joyous, isn't it? Just to have conversations when you're being able to expand your ideas and share and get feedback. So it's much appreciated. And to your followers, keep on keeping on.
Thanks, David.
All righty. Take care.